You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Lustig with NewsHour. At least 400 people are reported to have been killed and many thousands have been injured in a major earthquake in a remote region of western China. It happened in Qinghai province, which borders Tibet to the southwest and Sichuan to the southeast. That's where tens of thousands of people were killed in a devastating earthquake 2 years ago. Diana Dodd works with the international charity ROCPA, which operates in the town of Yushu, close to the epicentre, and she's been in touch with people there in the hours since the quake struck.
We've been hearing of hundreds dead, confusion, panic, lots, thousands injured, a complete devastation of a town, of a whole town.
You've been to the town, haven't you?
Many times, yes.
Describe it for us.
It's about two big major streets and two rivers flowing through it, surrounded by mountains. It sits about 3,500 metres high. It will be very cold right now, particularly at night. People will have no shelter.
What time of day was it when
it was
the quake actually struck? 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
So people will have been up, some people will have been on their way to school, on their way to work.
Thank goodness children will have been in school, yes, and wouldn't have been in their beds.
Right, and as far as you know, the schools were not among buildings that were affected?
They were. Our orphan school, I've just heard, the whole of the dormitory fell down. The school's now organising a camp. They have tents, so they're very, very lucky, because most people in the town won't have anywhere to stay
tonight. But the children in that building are OK, are they?
One teacher died.
Right.
Neighbours, we know of neighbours, relatives of the children who've died. One of our teachers died. We've just heard of 100 people in a nearby village where one of our former students live who've all died.
Is this an area where buildings would have been erected with earthquakes in mind?
I doubt it. I'd never heard of an earthquake there before. Apparently the last one I've just found out today was in 1975, but I'd never known of earthquakes in that area.
And what kind of building materials do they use? Are the buildings made of wood or of concrete?
Most of the housing that seems to have been mostly damaged is built from wood and adobe, mud and straw, but wooden structures, some with low walls, stone walls as well.
So the picture you've got then, from what you've been hearing over the last few hours, is of people very scared, very apprehensive, and a lot of them presumably now out in the open because they don't want to be inside a building.
They must be out in the open. They're expecting more aftershocks. So it's running away from the town is what we're hearing, out to a big grassland area where the famous Yushu Horse Festival takes place. That's what we're hearing, with the direction that people are going. There's particularly damage to one of the main monasteries just on the outskirts of the town. So people won't be able... roads are down. There is an airport nearby, and I read of an emergency service getting in, but the roads are all up and damaged. So how they're going to get to the town? They're desperate for tents, medicines and food.
Well, that was Diana Dodd of the international charity ROCPA. So she says the big need is for tents, medicine and food, but how quickly can they get there? I asked Francis Marcus of the International Committee of the Red Cross. He's in Chengdu in neighbouring Sichuan province.
It is challenging because the roads are in a bad state anyway, very, very far by road from the provincial capital. And so it is going to be a road journey of quite a number of hours before any supplies start getting there. We've seen that the government is trying to mobilize digging and cutting equipment from all over China, but actually getting it in there is quite challenging.
And would the area have been prepared for an earthquake? I mean, will they have resources that they can call on immediately and that are already locally available?
The general area of Qinghai and indeed Tibet bordering on it has been struck by quite a number of earthquakes. But as your last speaker said, these rural houses made of adobe and timber, I mean, they are not earthquake, they're not earthquake resistance resistant in themselves, but generally, because they are sort of relatively flimsy structures, if you like, people are more likely to survive the collapse of one of those houses, statistically speaking, than a concrete house.
Diana was also saying very cold at night still at this time of year. That means that shelter, obviously, is an important priority.
Yes, absolutely. The Red Cross Society of China is mobilising tents and quilts and blankets, as is the government, but it's a challenge to get them there in the numbers in which people need them fast enough. And also, with the number of injured, the medical treatment is going to be an urgent priority.
Well, that was Francis Marcus of the International Committee of the Red Cross in China. So let's look now at what kind of a place Qinghai Province is. Andrew Fisher from the Institute of Social Studies at the Erasmus University in Rotterdam lived there for a time, and he's been describing it for me.
It's a high-altitude Tibetan area. It's actually smack in the middle of Tibet. It's recognized even by the Chinese government as a Tibet Autonomous Prefecture. So the rural population is almost entirely Tibetan and largely nomadic, although some farming. And the Chinese, basically the urban population would be a mix of half Chinese, half Tibetan. I think that's probably where most of the fatalities happen, in the urban areas.
Very mountainous?
Yeah, very mountainous and very high altitude.
So scattered communities then, not huge groups of people all living in great huge conurbations?
Well, what you tend to find in these areas is that it's you have like primate cities or towns, in the sense that you have very few towns, but where the towns exist, they're quite large and built up. So in Jaiku, where a lot of damage took place, is actually quite a large town considering the population of prefecture.
And just thinking about communications, getting help and materials to the area, roads presumably not built to withstand an earthquake of this kind, and therefore it is going to be tremendously difficult, isn't it, to move stuff around?
Well, it all depends, of course, on how the earthquake hit, because there's basically one road going down there supplying the area. The protests that there was a lot of protests back in the 2008, March 2008, when the Tibetans were protesting in this area, in Jaiku itself. And so there's been a big military buildup in that area. And ironically, in the context of the earthquake now, that might actually be a positive factor, because the military presence would be capable of responding probably much more quickly than a lot of these other organizations. And also, of course, because China has had a considerable experience with their earthquake in Sichuan in 2008, which was also actually in a Tibetan area.
But the people there will identify very closely with people in Tibet itself, I suppose, and they might have rather mixed feelings if they find the army suddenly offering them help and shelter.
I think it's a daily reality. I don't think it's a question of people. I mean, the army controls the area. It's run by the Chinese government, so I don't think it's a question of people finding that strange. I think it's...
They're used to it.
They're used to it.
That was Andrew Fisher of the Institute of Social Studies at the Erasmus University in Rotterdam. Well, inevitably, people are going to compare today's disaster with the earthquake 2 years ago in Sichuan, which killed so many people. I asked Raymond Lee, the head of the BBC's Chinese service, how do they compare?
Talking about the link between the earthquake today and also the Sichuan, Wenchuan earthquake 2 years ago. Actually, the Chinese state media also quote some of the experts at the National Earthquake Agency by saying, actually, the two earthquakes are linked one way or another because they're on the same sort of earthquake belt.
What lessons do you think Chinese authorities learnt from Sichuan? I mean, at the time, I remember, people said that their response was pretty impressive. But then, in the weeks and months afterwards, there was quite a lot of controversy, wasn't there?
Certainly, I think the biggest lesson the last time was how the government could mobilise the army to be, taking part into the whole rescue effort. And again, because of that, actually, earlier this year, the government passed a new law in the way allowing the government to mobilize the army in the case of a natural disaster. So I think this time probably would be a very good test case to see how effective that new law will be.
Andrew Fisher was just making the point that the people in the area, ethnic Tibetans, identify closely with Tibetans in Tibet, a strong army presence there, particularly after all of the unrest not so long ago. Is there a sense in which this is a far remote area of China, a long way from the eastern seaboard and from Beijing? a sense that the government isn't that interested in people there and it might be with people elsewhere in the country?
I would say so, in the way that I think for those local people, obviously, you know, I would imagine not many of them have seen so many army soldiers in their whole life. But then I think in such a sort of very unusual and exceptional cases, I think they will be more receptive to any help from any part of the country, even including the army officers.
One of the things that upset huge numbers of people after the Sichuan earthquake was the way in which so many schools collapsed and so many children in those schools were killed. Was anything done in the aftermath of that to try to ensure that public buildings, including schools, were better built?
As far as I know, all the local governments did try to do some sort of inspection, safety inspection, on all those public buildings. But then having said that, still, I think a big question mark in China is, even you have the sort of orders from the central government, then how effectively those orders will be taken by the local government.
The other question, of course, that arose last time was how much the local media and local NGOs were able to criticise, to raise questions about the way in which the authorities had responded. There was quite a lot of sensitivity about that. The same this time round, would you imagine?
Well, I think this time probably, to be fair to Chinese government or even Chinese media, they have been very quick to respond to the whole, you know, the earthquake crisis. And I think even the central government has responded very quickly. Now we have seen the president and the premier also, you know, already sort of involved in the whole, I would say, operation. So I think I'm sure Chinese government would take some lessons from, 2 years ago. But then, you know, we need to wait and see how far they could go.
Well, that was the head of the BBC's Chinese service, Raymond Lee. As you can imagine, it's been very difficult to get through to people in the area most affected. Communications are very difficult indeed. But we have been contacted by one woman from the town of Yushu, who is now living here in the UK. This is what she said. She said, "My family live in Yushu. Thankfully, they are all unhurt, but the streets are lined with approximately 2,000 dead. Virtually every building is destroyed. People have nowhere to live. They can't access their traditional tents as they're kept in the house." The official death toll, as we were saying earlier, so far is at least 400 dead. If you have any information of your own from the area, if you have contacts there, or indeed just your thoughts about what has happened, do get in touch. Our email address, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, and the telephone number for SMS text messages, 44 7786 20 60 80. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Coming up a bit later in the programme, we're going to be talking to voters in Northern England about the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, ahead of next month's general election.
Bless his cotton socks, I just think the guy's had a personality bypass. It's as simple as that. He was an excellent Chancellor, I have to agree with that, but as a Prime Minister, he doesn't fulfil people with confidence, and I can't really phrase it any better than that without being rude.
So a reminder of our main headlines. Hundreds of people have been killed and thousands have been injured in an earthquake in a remote area of western China. Most of the buildings in one town have collapsed. The Americans have expressed their support for the interim government which seized power in Kyrgyzstan a week ago. And there's a row in Poland over the decision to bury President Lech Kaczynski in a place traditionally reserved for kings and heroes. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Lustig with NewsHour. Now, you may remember the row that erupted last year over emails that were leaked from a British university, which climate change sceptics said showed that scientists there had manipulated their data to make the evidence for climate change look more convincing. Well, today, an independent review of their work by a team of scientists under the chairmanship of Lord Oxburgh, he's a former chief scientific advisor to the Ministry of Defence and former head of the Imperial College of Science, Technology and Medicine here in London. It's cleared them of any deliberate malpractice. This is what their report says. It says, we saw no evidence of any deliberate scientific malpractice in any of the work of the Climatic Research Unit. And had it been there, we believe that it is likely that we would have detected it. Rather, we found a small group of dedicated, if slightly disorganised, researchers who were ill-prepared for being the focus of public attention. So, is it a clean bill of health? I asked the BBC's environment analyst, Roger Harabin.
Well, from the inquiry panel's point of view, it most definitely is. You'll remember, it's only just a few days ago, Robin, that a committee of MPs came to exactly the same conclusion. And at that time, critics said, well, you know, what do these MPs know? They're not experts in this. They wouldn't be able to track it if there'd been any real sleight of hand with the data. But this panel that's just reported today included the president of the Royal Statistical Society here in the UK. And for them to say that they can't find any evidence of any wrongdoing, I think, really is quite significant. And there are a group of sceptics who won't agree with this, but there are another group of sceptics who will say, OK, you found no evidence of wrongdoing. We're not complaining about wrongdoing. We're complaining that the science wasn't good enough.
OK, so, but what do you make of this phrase, a slightly disorganised group of researchers? What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that, I mean, even people in the University of East Anglia will attest to this, because I know many of them. The Climatic Research Unit is a sort of little bunker-like building separated from the main university. And just as in other small units, it has grown up in a fairly informal way, doing its procedures in a fairly informal fashion. And this is the second committee now to criticise the lack of data keeping or poor data keeping from that unit, and whilst also saying that they were honest scientists trying to go about their business in the best way. And I think actually, Robin, some of the more interesting comments today come not about the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. They do mildly criticise their statistical methodology, by the way, but not significantly. I think the significant comments come today are about the hockey stick graph, which is the graph used by Michael Mann, the American academic, to depict global temperatures, which it says exaggerates the temperature rise. The temperature rise is real, but not as much as depicted in the hockey stick graph. And then also, I think very interestingly, the panel today criticised the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the governmental panel with governmental representatives on it, for failing to properly represent the uncertainties in climate science. Okay. And they say the University of East Anglia is not guilty of that, but the people who represent their work have been guilty of it.
The BBC's environment analyst, Roger Harabin. Well, I've also been talking to the science writer, Andrew Montford. He's written a book about what he calls Climate Gate and the Corruption of Science. I asked him if he's satisfied with the report's conclusions.
No, I'm not. As with all these things, the critical question is to ask, what was the scope of the investigation? If we go back to the parliamentary panel, it appears that they didn't actually look into an awful lot of the allegations, and this new scientific panel has also had a very limited scope.
Well, they've looked at all of the work that this unit did in this area, as I understand it, some 30 pieces of research or more, and they say they have found no evidence of deliberate malpractice.
Yeah. What they've done is to look at some of the scientific papers, but what they've failed to do, and they freely admit this in their report, that they haven't looked at the specific allegations that have been made. There are some extremely serious allegations that have been made, which neither the parliamentary panel nor this scientific panel have looked at. If I can give you an example there, Professor Ross McKittrick has alleged that Professor Jones, the head of the CRU, inserted statements into the IPCC reports that were without basis in the scientific literature.
Is there anything that anyone will say, reviewing what went on, that would satisfy you?
If they looked at the allegations and present evidence that the allegations are without foundation, then I think that would satisfy us. Professor McKittrick has listed what evidence the various panels would need to see to disprove the allegation of fabrication, but the parliamentary panel don't appear to have looked at the question at all, despite the fact they've exonerated Professor Jones on all counts, and the scientific panel don't appear to have looked at it either. They appear to be going through the motions rather than actually doing a proper investigation.
The climate change sceptic, Andrew Montford. Now, among the dozens of world leaders who gathered in Washington this week for the Nuclear Security Summit, there was one man for whom it was all a very new experience. He was the acting president of Africa's most populous nation, Nigeria, and this was his first foreign visit since he took over in February. His name is Goodluck Jonathan, and he was sworn in as acting head of state because the president, Umaru Yar'Adua, is in very poor health. In fact, very little's known of his true condition. So when the head of the BBC's Hausa service, Jamila Tangaza, spoke to the acting president in Washington, she asked him, when was the last time that he saw President Yar'Adua?
In terms of the last time we really had sustained discussion, that was 26th of November. I think he left by early hours of the 24th of November. Then on the 26th, we spoke extensively. Since then, we've not really had any sustained discussion.
Since his return to Nigeria almost 2 months ago, have you seen him?
No, I have not.
Have you spoken with him, sir?
No.
What is your opinion? Do you speak with his doctors? Are you aware of what exactly is going on regarding his health?
No, I don't know exactly, because I've not seen the doctor. I've heard about three occasions I've had discussions with the wife, and I've been discussing with some of the other aides. But the doctor, I have not even seen him.
Why is that, sir?
Of course, he has not come to me, and I wouldn't want to compel him.
One of the issues that was raised by President Obama during your visit here in the U.S. is the issue of corruption. Now, President Obama stated that the U.S., and indeed himself, are keen to see that you take some tangible measures in terms of fighting corruption in Nigeria. How do you see that call?
I think Nigeria is one country that we are really fighting corruption. But the problem of the perception in society is that there are some people that people have in mind that they are corrupt. And until those people are jailed, nobody will believe that they are fighting corruption, which is quite wrong. If you look at what has happened in Nigeria, look at what has happened to the MDs of banks. So many bank MDs were detained for a very long time. They still have cases in court and with EFCC. I'm not aware of any other country that so many MDs of banks were arrested at the same time and been prosecuted. But nobody seems to be bothering about that. Nobody even commends the country for doing that. Even in terms of governors, most of the past governors have been investigated, they've been prosecuted. What I can assure Nigerians and the rest of society is that the fight against corruption will continue.
The ex-governors, some of them were investigated and found to be wanting, but they were told to return only a meager sum of something like $10,000. Some say that is more or less a joke. Do you agree?
It is ridiculous, but we need to know the examples. Because I know there's only one governor that had a plea bargain, and it was not $10,000.
But
so I don't know the reference they are making.
The former,
but I, as a person, my policy is not to interfere, because it will give a very wrong impression. It's the people that have the responsibility to investigate them. To me, it will not portray me as a good leader for me to condemn people before the law enforcement agencies should even investigate and try them.
The acting Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Lustig with NewsHour. Now, suppose a state with nuclear weapons or nuclear material was tempted to make them available to a terrorist group. That's the threat that nuclear security summit in Washington has been considering this week, and among the leaders there was the French President Nicolas Sarkozy. He thinks you might need more than just an agreement on how to secure nuclear materials. He says there should be some way to prosecute states or their leaders if there's evidence that they have passed on nuclear know-how.
We must also think about countries whose leaders want to help terrorists prepare and carry out a nuclear attack by providing nuclear materials, know-how, or explosives, because there is an international legal vacuum on this issue. In these instances, I have suggested that the state may be prosecuted and sentenced by an international tribunal under the auspices of the UN. This could be by modifying the statutes of the International Criminal Court to broaden its remit, or by creating an ad hoc tribunal to fill the gap in international law.
So, could there in fact be something along the lines that the President suggests? Maurice Mendelssohn is a British lawyer who specialises in international law. He's Emeritus Professor at the University of London. So I asked him if President Sarkozy is right. Is there an international legal vacuum?
Not entirely. It is the case that you can't prosecute states for handing over nuclear or radioactive weapons, but in practical terms, even if you could prosecute states as such, it would be very difficult. I mean, what would the damages be? If you got an injunction, how would you enforce it? So the idea of going against states is perhaps not a very useful one.
Okay, but let's look at leaders then. I mean, suppose there was really good evidence that a particular named leader had authorised the transfer of nuclear know-how, nuclear materials even, to a terrorist group. Couldn't the International Criminal Court do something about it?
The International Criminal Court might be able to do something about it. It would depend partly on whether the particular state was a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court, and not all of them are. There are also problems about whether, if the weapon hasn't been used, for example, whether a conspiracy to provide people with the ability to use such a weapon would be sufficient to create an offence under the statute of the International Criminal Court. So it's a bit iffy, but it's not out of the question that one could do it.
I was just wondering, as things stand, if I got my hands on some enriched uranium, which was enriched to a sufficient degree to be useful for weapons purposes, and I handed it over to a terrorist group, could I be prosecuted?
Well, there is another treaty, the 2005 UN Convention for the Suppression of Acts of Nuclear Terrorism, which requires the states which are parties to it to make it a crime under their own national law for a person to possess such weapons or for a person to conspire with another to use such weapons. There is a mechanism, if you like, but first of all, only 65 out of approximately 200 states are parties to it so far. And secondly, even if the state in question had signed up to this convention and was in principle committed to making it a crime under their own law, in practice, delivery could be difficult. Responsibility, prosecution.
The international lawyer, Professor Maurice Mendelssohn. Now, over the past decade or so, the economy in Zimbabwe almost entirely imploded. Critics of President Robert Mugabe blamed his controversial land reform policies, which transferred ownership of many of the country's most successful farms from their white owners to veterans of Zimbabwe's War of Independence. Many of the farms stopped being productive. And over the past few years, some 4 million Zimbabweans, that's about one-third of the total population, have fled the country looking for work. The overwhelming majority of those who stayed behind have no formal employment. President Mugabe and his supporters say that the policy was essential to right the wrongs from Zimbabwe's colonial past. So now, as the economy begins to revive, with President Mugabe sharing power with the former opposition MDC party, what is the picture on the farms? Dan Isaacs has been travelling through Zimbabwe to see what price people have paid for the reforms and to meet the new owners of the land.
This, for me, what I'm looking out at now is farmland as far as the eye can see in all directions. It used to be highly intensive, mechanised, farmed land. None of it now is being used. It's all turned back to grassland. And this farm here is owned by one of the most senior war veterans who I've come here to meet.
My name is Comrade Andy Mhlanga. As war veterans, we are satisfied that the program of land reform succeeded. It might not be 100%, but we succeeded because the land is now with the people of Zimbabwe.
Even though senior war veterans like Andy Mhlanga did well out of land reform, they haven't been able to cultivate the land as they want to, and they blame that on the lack of access to investment. So I wanted to find a farm where the new owners have been able to make a go of it, to use the land efficiently, despite the very real economic challenges they face. So I've come here, to the farm run by Stan Kasekwere and his wife Jane. Stan is well connected. He has businesses in Harare and is the brother of a senior government minister. And he's been allocated a large farm on prime tobacco-growing land.
Every farmer cherishes his farm when it's fully utilized, when you've done everything, when you've made use of any part of your land. As you can see, me and my wife, Jane, are so much involved with this farm.
The lunch table at Stan and Jane's farmhouse has been set out in the garden, in the shade of a spreading jacaranda tree.
You know, it's funny, they say Mugabe is always saying hurtful things and all that. British is doing exactly the same, only in a very silent manner by doing these sanctions and all that. It's equally the same. Only Mugabe is being vocal about
actions
it.
Actions speak louder than
than words. He's being vocal about it. He's a frustrated man. Whereas for me, I didn't see the struggle. I'm just now enjoying what somebody fought for.
This is the very different side of land reform. These are tobacco silos that were once full at this time of year of the harvested tobacco. Now they're being lived in by the former farm workers who've been chased off the nearby farm.
My name is Johannes Lengestein.
How long have you been here living in these tobacco warehouses? How long?
3 years now. Mm. Because we don't have where to go.
And you are here with your family?
Yes. I've got 3 kids and 1 wife.
And there is no help from anyone to find you a place to stay, and there is no work for farmers?
Nothing.
All right, thank you. Thank you for showing me your house. Well, I've come back now, finally, to end my journey in Harare, to track down one of those absent farm owners. Bright Matonga is a former government minister and currently a ZANU-PF member of Parliament.
Well, you've got to understand, it was a revolution, but now things have calmed down, production will pick up, and people have realised that the land reform is irreversible.
But what about, for example, the farm that you were allocated, Citrus Farm? There is no production, no cultivation going on there since the farm came into your hands. Why is that?
No, my farm is, I would say, nearly 100% utilised. Mm. I've utilised every piece of land on my farm. But you've got to understand these challenges on finance.
I'm slightly confused about that because I have seen, I've driven past kilometres of citrus tree plantation where the grass is as high as the trees. Now, that's not efficient use of the land.
Yeah, what you've got to understand, for effective production, you need capital. There is no capital, very minimum capital in the banks. But again, and I'm saying that things are, there is a great improvement because now the banks are now responding. They see that agriculture is the backbone of sustainable development in Zimbabwe.
Bright Matonga is right. The backbone of Zimbabwe's economy is agriculture. But it has been broken by the land reform process. Some in Zimbabwe believe the costs have been worth it. Plenty more do not. And although Robert Mugabe, the 86-year-old veteran leader of Zimbabwe, has many political enemies, few have been able to effectively challenge him over land reform. To do so is to face being painted a colonial puppet and anti-black empowerment. So the land redistribution process is a done deal. And it's now up to the new owners of the land to learn to farm it well, for the sake of all Zimbabweans.
Well, that was Dan Isaacs reporting. You can hear more about that on this week's assignment programme here on the BBC World Service. Another controversial reform policy that was meant to come into effect in Zimbabwe last month was a law under which all foreign-owned companies there would be forced to sell a 51% stake in their local subsidiaries to black Zimbabweans. But now the government says that the law has been suspended for consultations and that all regulations relating to it are null and void. Well, Dan's with me now here in the NewsHour studio. Dan, this is quite a change, isn't it? Why?
It is very much. Well, it was seen as, if you like, part two of the black empowerment process. You had land and now you had foreign companies. But I think what has troubled those within the Zimbabwe government is that foreign companies and businesses within Zimbabwe realised what the scale of the crisis, the economic crisis that could ensue if they went ahead with this. It would mean that foreign companies investing $100 now in Zimbabwe would have to give away
$51 within the next 5 years. And so they've either scrapped or suspended to look at it again.
Now, this was a law that I think was first enacted when the government was just ZANU-PF. It's now, as I was saying, a coalition government with the MDC included. Is this a sign that the MDC is actually being able to influence policy?
Well, quite clearly there is, if you like, turmoil within the government. But what you have to understand is that these people in government are also in business, have the interests of business at heart, are involved intimately in those businesses and see the consequences of further turmoil in Zimbabwe. And I think the realism, the realisation that things could go seriously wrong when Zimbabwe is coming, if you like, into some sort of economic stability right now after the turmoil of the land reform, that this could again throw Zimbabwe off kilter. That's what I think is worrying people within government.
They say it is suspended for consultations. What does that mean?
Very seriously suspended. I think we're going to see a suspension for a long time to come, if not a permanent one.
Dad, many thanks. Dan Isaacs there on the latest from Zimbabwe. Now, here in Britain, the second biggest opposition party, the Liberal Democrats, launched their election manifesto today, just 3 weeks ahead of the general election that is due here early next month. There's no expectation that the party will actually win the election, but the opinion polls suggest that they might hold the balance of power if neither of the two biggest parties win an overall majority in the House of Commons. Today, the Lib Dems leader, Nick Clegg, said his party's key message was how to create a fairer society.
Our manifesto says this is what Liberal Democrats want for Britain. Fair taxes that put money back in your pocket. A fair chance for all of our children at school. A fair future, creating jobs by going green. And a fair deal, cleaning up politics once and for all. A country, in short, that we can all be proud of. A country where you can reach your extraordinary potential. If that's what you want, vote for us.
Well, much of the focus in this election campaign, of course, is on how much each of the main parties would deal with the aftermath of the economic crisis, and in particular, with Britain's huge budget deficit. The Lib Dems finance spokesman, Vince Cable, said the other main parties are trying not to talk about it.
The point is that we take the economy seriously. We take the government deficit seriously. That's the elephant in the room. The elephant was banished yesterday and the day before at the Labour and the Tory press launches. We don't think you can banish it. We have to confront it. And I guess I'm the elephant man.
So, lots of talk in this manifesto about fairness, but surely that's something that all political parties say they're in favour of. So what does set the Lib Dems apart from their rivals? Janet Parry has been reading the manifesto.
What we've heard this week, we've had the Liberal Democrats manifesto launched today, the Conservatives yesterday, Labour on Monday. They've all had their watchwords, haven't they, Robin? We've heard a lot about change from the Conservatives. We heard a lot about the future from Labour, and fair and fairness certainly seems to be what the Liberal Democrats are trying to home in on this manifesto. Nick Clegg, we heard in there, he says he wants to break down privilege, and there's the four areas: fair taxes, a fair chance, a fair future, a fair deal that they're talking about. They're talking about cutting class sizes, big tax cuts for the lowest earning people in the UK, coming down very hard on the banks by doing things like capping bankers' bonuses, and cleaning up politics. There have been a lot of scandals involving MPs' expenses in the UK. They say they'd give people the right to sack MPs if they'd found to have done wrong. And crucially, and we heard a bit about it there from Vince Cable, they say they're going to be able to make £15 billion worth of savings a year. That's about $23 billion worth of savings. And they say they've managed to cost them in comparison to the other two main parties, who they say are a bit sort of woolly about their figures.
It's always difficult for the Liberal Democrats, Janet, isn't it, as the third party to sort of make space for themselves in British politics. Now, what they usually seem to do in previous elections, at least, was to find one policy that people can grab hold of, one distinctive policy. This year they're saying they can take a lot of people who are the least well paid out of the taxation system altogether.
Yes, that is certainly what they've been saying, what we've been hearing them say today. I mean, I suppose there are lots of different areas that they've been looking at today, and where Nick Clegg and his team hope or trying to make some sort of difference is by saying we're not one of the other two. He talked about a stitch-up between Labour and the Conservatives over the last 65 years, and saying maybe you're ready for a change now and we can offer you something different.
J. Janet Barry there on the Liberal Democrats' manifesto, published today after the Conservatives published theirs yesterday. Labour Party published theirs on Monday. The election campaign up and running. All those manifestos, by the way, available on the BBC website if you'd like to have a look at them for yourself. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Just a reminder of today's main news, that major earthquake in western China, which is reported to have killed several hundred people. Earlier in the programme, we heard from a British charity worker who has been in touch with people in the area.
We've been hearing of hundreds dead, confusion, panic, thousands injured, and a complete devastation of a whole town. It will be very cold right now, particularly at night. People will have no shelter.
Other news, the Americans have expressed their support for the interim government which seized power in Kyrgyzstan a week ago. There's a row in Poland over the decision to bury President Lech Kaczynski, who died in a plane crash last Saturday, in a place traditionally reserved for kings and heroes. And a former Chinese police chief has been condemned to death for corruption, rape and links with gangsters. You're listening to the BBC. This is Robin Lustig with NewsHour, where we were talking about the British Liberal Democrat Party just a few moments ago. They're the third biggest party in UK politics. And here on NewsHour, we're reporting on all three of the main parties in the run-up to the election next month. We've already looked at the Conservatives, so today let's look at the Labour Party, which has been in power for the past 13 years, ever since Tony Blair led them to victory in 1997. The opinion polls are suggesting that Labour won't win this time round, that after a deep economic recession and with a much less popular leader, Gordon Brown, many former Labour voters think that it is now time for a change. NewsHour's Marianne Seacott has been talking to voters in Yorkshire, in northern England, in what's traditionally thought of as a solidly Labour-supporting part of the country.
The Triglington Brass Band, one of the traditional sounds of working-class northern England. Voting Labour's a tradition here too. But in next month's general election, Labour, which has governed Britain for the past 13 years, looks set to take a bit of a battering. Kevin Dawson, who plays second trombone in the brass band, isn't impressed by the Labour Prime Minister, Gordon Brown.
Bless his cotton socks, I just think the guy's had a personality bypass. It's as simple as that. He was an excellent Chancellor, I have to agree with that, but as a Prime Minister, he doesn't fulfil people with confidence, and I can't really phrase it any better than that without being rude.
And then the last one, you ready? If you're happy and you know it, wave goodbye. Bye, bye, bye!
So why might Britain be waving goodbye to Labour? Well, it's partly a result of having been in power so long. In nearby Morley, Deborah Smith runs a mother and toddler group called Shore Mums.
Well, I've changed my mind recently. I've sort of been towards Labour for the last, well, however long that they've been in Downing Street. However, I think it is definitely time for change, so I'm sort of going for Conservative this time.
This seat's being fought by Gordon Brown's right-hand man. Ed Ball started working for Mr Brown back in 1994 when Labour was still in opposition. Now he's in the Cabinet as Minister for Children, Schools and Families. I've come into the Covered Market in Morley. It's full of stalls selling, well, relatively cheap stuff. And we've come to talk to Jeff, who's known as the main man of the market. He's got quite a big clothes stall, lots of T-shirts with glitter on and that sort of thing.
The Conservative man has been showing his face probably every week, and then a bit often he talks to the market manager, who waves and says hello to me, he'll discuss things. He's obviously working hard for the position. We haven't seen Ed Balls at all.
The opposition Conservatives never used to bother much with this area. They thought they didn't have a chance. Their candidate is Anthony Calvert.
Historically, this constituency has been Labour because we have let it be the Labour constituency that it has for generations now, and since the 1930s. We think we've got a great chance this time.
Now, you've described yourself as a beer and sandwiches Tory. What does that mean?
Beer and sandwiches conservatism is the sort of working-class conservative background that I was brought up in. Your parents are both hard-working, and they're not born with a silver spoon in their mouths. They've not inherited lots of wealth. They just graft. They work as hard as they can, and they want to protect themselves, their families, their communities.
The far-right anti-immigration British National Party is also strong here, despite the area being 98% white. Their candidate is Chris Beverley.
Our supporters are very excited about the coming contest. And, you know, for the first time ever in our history as a party, we've actually got a chance of winning seats at this next general election. Some people are saying that Morley and Outwood is one of those seats that we could actually win. So, obviously, you know, it's a very exciting time for us.
The Liberal Democrats aren't fighting this seat very hard, preferring to concentrate on a more winnable seat in nearby Leeds. Their candidate is James Monaghan.
In Morley, we are fighting a campaign. We just don't have the money of the other parties. So we're not backed by big business or the trade unions. So all our effort comes from volunteers. And we are working in Morley and Outwood constituency. But we have other areas where we have a stronger organisation and we're putting effort in.
What would you like?
A couple of white coffees, please.
We'd like sugar in that?
No, thanks.
Right, £2.60.
Well, I've come to Bertie's Diner. It's a big American diner in the middle of the high street of Morley. It's got red vinyl banquettes, Elvis and Marilyn Monroe on the wall with lots of American license plates and retro ads. And the owner's Bob Lacey. He's got a big tattoo on his forearm and hair going right down to the small of his back in a ponytail. He thinks it's time for a change.
I'm thinking of voting for the first time since Margaret Thatcher, Conservative. We've got to start doing something now for the small businessmen. Across there is a shop closed down only yesterday and moved out. There's shops closed down everywhere because they can't afford to stay open.
Labour, like most governing parties, is paying the price of the recession. Britain, with its high levels of debt and reliance on the finance sector, has been particularly badly hit. And voters blame Gordon Brown personally. He was finance minister for 10 years before he took over from Tony Blair as prime minister in 2007. Deborah Smith of Shaw Mums again.
I don't like him as much as Tony Blair, to be quite honest with you. I don't think he's a very strong candidate, that's what I would say. Like, Tony Blair was very strong when he came out, and there was just something about him that, you know, just seemed like where we are now today with probably David Cameron.
Ed Balls insists that Labour is still on course to win.
There will be people who say it's time for a change, but the choice isn't change or no change. The choice is, what kind of change do you want? And I think a change which took you back to less support for pensioners, rising VAT, high youth unemployment, all the things people remember in the constituency from the 1980s. I never have people saying to me, we want David Cameron.
It's not all over for Labour by any means. Although they're behind in the polls, the electoral system is biased in their favour. The Conservatives need a share of the vote 9 points greater than Labour before they can even win a parliamentary majority. And at the moment, their lead's about 7 points. And Labour can still rely on a solid core of voters who'll never abandon the party. Back in Bertie's diner, Rhoda Wall, 82, is having a late breakfast with her husband.
My mum and dad, they always campaign for Labour, so I'd feel I would be letting them down and they would turn in the grave if I didn't vote Labour, because it was such an important issue in our home when I was a little girl, that they were vote Labour, 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 and I just can't do anything else.
Voters in Yorkshire there talking to Marianne Seacart. Next week, the Liberal Democrats and Julian Marshall. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could harness all of the energy that's generated by people as they walk along a city street? Well, in the French city of Toulouse, you soon will be able to, because the city authorities there are going to install special modules in the pavements which will harness the energy that's generated by people walking along and then use it to power a street lamp. The technology was first developed for use on a dance floor in a nightclub in Rotterdam. So I asked Jaap van den Braak of the company that developed it if the idea now is to turn the streets of Toulouse into a dance floor.
Hopefully we can.
Now, how much power is actually generated by this means?
The pavement is built out of different modules that are 75 by 75 centimetres, and each module can produce up to 30 watts, depending on how heavily people are moving on the pavement modules.
OK, so the more people walk by, and the heavier they are, presumably, the more power you get.
Yeah, and the higher they jump, and the more they dance.
Oh, I see. OK, well, if you had them all dancing along the pavement, you'd be able to power several street lamps then, would you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Just one thought, though. Is this a serious technology, or is it just a bit of fun to get more publicity for your dance floors?
No, absolutely not. This is what we're actually aiming for in the future. At this moment, the cost of producing those modules is still really high. So it's hard to make it cost efficient when people are walking and producing energy. But for the future, this is what we're really envisioning.
Jaap van den Braak on a new way of generating electricity. That brings us to the end of the programme, so thank you for listening. I'm Robin Lustig. This has been NewsHour from the BBC.